you hear that? A gang member was shot in a restaurant.
He was carrying a gun.
In Chicago. He was carrying a weapon. The guy that was shot, they didn't say what the weapon was. It may have been a pea shooter. It may have been a cork gun or a knife or a gun.
A pistol. Savers time ends tomorrow.
Time ends tomorrow?
Part of it does. You are in the mood today, Serge. Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealthcare, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we should disclose immediately that we are also, Jeff and Jake McClure, are also the principals and managing members of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, known as the Personal Wealth Coach, same as the radio program. But what we talk about on this radio program is not investment advice, because we don't give investment advice.
Well, we talk about investment advice.
We talk about investment advice, but we don't give it.
Not on the program.
We give education, and there's a difference. Investment advice is individual, and each individual needs to have a thorough assessment and evaluation before investment advice is rendered.
Let's give an example of what we won't say. We won't say, you should buy this much of this thing.
Right.
Because that would be specific.
Or go out and immediately and invest in...
fill in the blank.
Oh,
we should.
Can we make
a company called Fill in the Blank.
I think... one of the most brilliant reasons that Lowe's still exists. Buy on the lows, sell on the highs.
Yeah, see.
So you notice that Lowe's exists, but highs doesn't.
No.
So obviously,
nobody
subconsciously,
wanted to buy on the highs.
Everybody goes to Lowe's and buys.
Well, maybe not. It just depends on the time frame.
Well, is Lowe's the best buy is the question.
No, Best Buy is the Lowe's. Wait a minute, that's not right either.
Well, Best Buy isn't low, but...
We're in a bit of a mood this morning.
Tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, is the longest day of the year.
Well,
a lot of people think it's like January, like June 21st or 22nd. I don't get that.
When you're talking about the solstice of the
summer solstice.
Summer solstice is technically the day with the
longest
most
daylight
sunlight, but the longest day of the year is a day in which we arbitrarily put another hour in it.
Right. And then we take it back out again. Another time in the year. But tomorrow is a 25-hour day.
Yeah.
Spring forward, fall back. So tomorrow morning, in the wee hours of the morning, what is it between 1
it's
and
not
2?
Really 25 hours, though.
It is.
It's 24 hours where 1 hour is repeated.
That's it. You get
it's
to
still,
see.
It's the 24th hour happens
right.
Twice.
You get... well, actually, it's the second hour that happens twice.
It's the second.
Actually, hour. No, third hour, because from midnight to 1, midnight to 1, just midnight to 1.
So 1
between
to 2.
1 and 2,
happens
the time
twice.
Repeat. So tomorrow night, you can do what you've been wanting to do all along, which is sleep 2 hours in 1, meaning that you only get you can only need half as much sleep, but we'll take it back in the spring.
Yes, you get 2 hours for the price of 1. Don't spend your time unwisely.
Right. And if you happen to ever be up doing scientific work that is time-stamped,
Got to be careful at this point.
And the precise time you do it is really critical, and you have to be doing it in the wee hours of the morning on the day that time switches from daylight savings time to regular time.
I just see it being
very
challenged.
Confusing.
How is it that you made the change to your discovery 30 minutes before you discovered it to change it?
Yes.
Oh.
Actually, I ran into that once before. But
did it hurt?
Yes. Because I couldn't figure it out.
So all of this is to say some things. It's a nice segue into...
Segue. Ooh, is that our big word for the day?
Right. It's a nice segue into taxes. Because taxes are just as arbitrary as daylight savings.
Is segue a sequitur?
No, it's a non sequitur. If you're using it improperly.
But if you're using it properly, it's a sequitur.
Right. A segue sequitur.
Right.
Which sounds like a nice new model number for the Segway company to use.
Well, actually, the Segway sequitur this week was a tax proposal.
Yes.
But it hasn't passed the Ways and Means Committee yet.
It hasn't passed anything except for into public view.
Well, a bunch of Republicans got together and said, let's do it, and it's sort of a pass.
Well, there's no... there may have been a vote, but it wasn't recorded, and it wasn't an official vote of Congress. Mm-hmm. So what we have is a very, very incomplete blueprint. We've already had lots of people ask us, what does that mean for my house? Well, it depends on what they do with the blueprint from here on.
House is a very, very, very fine house.
Yes. With lots of taxes for you.
For most of the people, I think, who listen to this radio program, I hope, both of you.
Is it just the two of us?
Yes.
It is, isn't it? I knew it. We're the only ones listening.
It looks like, according to the proposal, the only major difference is there's several major differences, but one of them is a much smaller, if it passed exactly as it is, a much smaller number of people will need to itemize on their income tax. Like maybe two-thirds of the people who currently have to itemize this year won't. But, and you know, the funny thing about the house thing, okay, you want?
Yeah, let me throw this in here, because a lot of people don't even know anything about it. They hear little bits here and there from different news sources, and most of that is focused in on each straw in the straw bale. They haven't really gotten a chance to step back and say, what is different about this proposal than what exists?
And it's 400 pages long, and that's without, there's no footnotes. The proposals don't have all the little administrative things about the Paperwork
right.
Reduction Act. You know, when they quoted the Obama Care Act, they talked about how long it was. Well, actually, the vast majority of how long it was that people were quoting is just Paperwork Reduction Act and the other kind of boilerplate that always has to go on things like this.
Right.
This proposal was a clean proposal without any of the disclaiming footnotes that have to go with government documents.
Now, to give it...
And it was 400 pages long.
To give it some pass on that, a big chunk of that was the repeal of the alternative minimum tax, which doesn't appear in just one law, but in about 12 dozen, because they've had to extend it every year and make changes to it every year. For the past 12 dozen, not exactly 144 years. But, you know, it's not gross.
You've got to look at it to make sure that they repealed everything.
You know why I'm using the word 12 dozen, right?
Because it's 144?
That's a gross.
It is pretty
gross. Literally, it's a gross, and I think the tax bills all in all are gross, so there I am.
Yeah. Well, gross just means big.
Yeah, it's 144 when you're using numbers, so 12 groups of 12 is a gross. Mm-hmm. And a dozen, so a dozen dozens is a gross
right. On
the base 12 system. And I think that it's appropriate to say that 12 dozen changes to the AMT.
That makes sense.
Okay,
it's
so what? Let's give a real quick generalized view. And I'm going to be really, really general.
You aren't going to be a general.
I'm going to be a lieutenant general.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No, I think you'll probably be a full general, but that's all right.
I think this is enough anticipation. Everyone is now primed to hear about the exciting world of taxes.
Ooh.
All two of us. All right. So the biggest change to this proposal is the doubling of the standard deduction. Okay. What does that even mean? Everybody has a deduction. It's a standard thing, which is why they call it a standard deduction. It's kind of an arbitrary, random number that's been thrown out and tweaked a little bit by Congress over the years, sometimes by inflation and other times just because Congress felt like it. Well, they've doubled the size of it. And what it means is that you don't have to worry about how much you spent on mortgage interest or on property taxes or in charity or a lot of the other things that people that do itemized deductions do, unless you've spent more on those things than the standard deduction.
Here is a key I want to throw in here. People asking about their houses.
Let's not get into the details.
Okay, here. But this has to do with the doubling of the standard deduction.
Right.
People say, is my mortgage deduction still deductible? Well, yeah, but you probably won't deduct it because your standard deduction went up high enough that
right.
the standard deduction, and so, this is going to have a profound effect, I think, on the price of houses.
Most of the terror news that you get out there, the inflammatory news, state, local taxes, not deductible anymore. Well, some of them are. And
right.
that's technical, and you can get into the quibbling over which straw you're talking about. But the end result is, depending on whose estimate you believe, somewhere around 30 to 35% of American tax filers go through the extremely arduous and tedious task of itemizing their deductions. Huge amounts of records are kept. I'm not talking about business taxes. This is just personal taxes, where you've got your pay and now you're itemizing your sales tax if you bought some cars. You're looking at your property taxes. You're looking at the interest on your mortgage. You're looking at charitable stuff. You're looking at all the things that your CPA has said for years. Keep records of all of this. Most of those haven't changed. Some of them have. But the big thing is that most people right now, 30 to 35% of people are doing it, are doing that standardized deduction or non-standardized, they're itemized deductions. Now it will be between 5 and 10% of the taxpayers, because the standard deduction will be big enough that you won't have to keep all those records. Most people don't spend $24,000 if they're married on mortgage interest. They don't spend $24,000 on mortgage interest and property taxes and sales tax and all the other things combined. The vast majority of people don't have to worry about that stuff. So what does that mean? It means that if you are itemizing after the end of this, it's possible that your taxes are going to go up a little bit. It's also possible for some people that have catastrophic medical conditions to have their taxes go up a little bit.
Well, actually, they could go up a bunch.
It could be a lot.
Basically, that's one of two things in this bill or this proposal that I think are bad.
And the reality of it is that the vast majority of people will get a tax cut using this bill. Is that good or bad?
Will they really get a tax cut?
Well, sort of. They'll pay less taxes.
Well, I don't know if they will or not. I've been doing a lot of analysis, and it is questionable. The reason I say it's questionable, you lose the individual tax credits.
But you get a
you get a bigger standard deduction.
The individual tax credits?
You
get some individual tax credits that didn't exist before.
You get an exemption, which is not a credit, but an exemption.
You get a
for every person in your family.
It's a credit.
Okay.
It's and a credit. $300 credit is now being given. An exemption went away.
Right. The point, you had personal exemptions.
Yes.
And they gave back a $300 credit. And when it
then goes, they raised the child tax credit to $1,600 from $1,000.
And if you work around through it, there are going to be some people who wind up paying in the lower income, lower to middle income areas, more taxes. Some will pay less taxes, but they have changed it so much
right.
that you probably won't be able to tell.
Right.
And the difference is really fairly small. The big thing about if you're just, you don't own a business and you're not the gazillionaire.
you're going to have a lot easier time filing taxes.
Yeah, it is indeed tax simplification, and that is one of the key elements here.
Wait, there's an oxymoron here, and I have to laugh about it a little bit. It is simplification through complexity.
Right.
They've added a lot of complexity to the code itself so that it is more simple for most people to do their taxes, but it's going to be a lot more complex if you own a small business.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out whether my taxes went up or down, and some of them go down and some of them go up. So some of them go sideways.
I said generally, so let me hit the general thing. The standardized deduction is bigger. That's one of the biggest things to take there. That's a huge difference.
The standard deduction.
Yes, the standard, not standardized. Right. Standard deduction. The other thing is that corporate tax rates are going to go down tremendously.
That's the biggie.
To 20% from 35. That's a really big one. There is kind of a transitionary weirdness when I say small business owners are going to have a lot more complexity, and that some of that is going to be taxed at income level, and some of that is going to be taxed at 25%, which is a whole new rate that didn't have anything to do with corporate stuff before or business stuff before. It's just their compromise number.
But if you're in a pass-through and you actually work in the business and it is not a service business, now
that's
all three of those, then you have to prove, the standard is you don't have to prove anything if you say, okay, 30% of what comes to me from my business is business and 70% is actually salary, so I get taxed at individual rates on 70% and 30% gets treated like a business.
There's one other piece. There's a difference here. This is when we talk about daylight savings time being arbitrary. If you're a business owner and you make $3, this is getting really simple here. You made $3. The IRS will look at that if this proposal goes forward. The IRS will look at that and say, okay, 70% of that, of those $3.
Why don't you make it $10 so that you
can... It's too simple.
It's much easier.
Okay, $10. $7 of that is your income. It's basically
like
what you would pay yourself if you were paying a salary.
Right.
Self-employment taxes are due on that. That would be the same as the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid,
actually,
all that
good stuff. Actually, self-employment tax due on all of it. But let's go ahead.
No, this is important.
Last 30%?
Last 30% is considered business income. Mm-hmm. And if it's paid in a dividend, you still don't pay the employment taxes. So business income is separate from compensation. It's the same dollars.
I didn't see that.
You should look at it. It's what they call compensation versus income. The big difference is that income from a business doesn't have self-employment taxes, but compensation from the business is a salary and has self-employment taxes on it. So people that have S corporations now, a lot of times will use they look around at the going rate for what they do. And they say, the average rate in the country for what I do is $70,000. So any dollar amount that I get from my business above that is in business income rather than compensation. And I don't know all the self-employment stuff. And so that's the complexity. There's no clear guideline given by anybody on how to do this. It's a pure negotiation between a CPA and an auditor to say, well, this seems to be acceptable sometimes. And that's the complexity for small business owners, unless you're just a purely service oriented. If you're an architect, an attorney, an investment advisor, a stockbroker, they don't consider that to be capital heavy businesses in the current proposal. Capital intensive. So they consider that all compensation. That's all self-employed stuff. And so basically what it means is that a lot of the small business owners that are not involved in the industry are not going to see the 25% tax rate.
They're not going to see it anywhere. What the National Federation of Independent Businesses and the National Chamber of Commerce both came out yesterday and said, it effectively raises taxes on small business owners.
Right. And that's really, they've got to come up with revenue somewhere, and we happen to have a target on us in this
one. Right.
We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh.
All right. That's a good question.
You want to change subjects or you want to go
well,
on?
Well, I mean, it's a nice little segue.
It is.
Because we've gotten a lot of people say something along the lines of the market has gone up because of the idea that tax reform is going to happen. I don't believe that's the case. I don't think you believe that's the case. When we look at the market movements based on any of the major economic proposals from Congress this year, we've seen no correlation. If this is something that's in the newsletter that we've sent out, if you look at the price-to-earnings ratio of the S&P 500 a year ago and look at it again today, what that is what are the earnings of the company versus what their costs to buy them are? So the price of the company versus the earnings of the company. And that ratio, you want it to be low because the lower the better. It means that you're getting more income for what you paid. We are at or below where we were 12 months ago while the market is up 24%. Earnings have come up as fast or slightly faster than the market has. So not that the market is ever purely rational, but we've had a lot of calmness there. There's not been a lot of volatility. Market has been priced fairly close to the earnings increases across the board, which makes me think that we're not enthusiastically as a people jumping into the stock market expecting some kind of great tax boon, because we don't know what to expect yet. And all of the failures in the Congress to get these big proposals passed this year say we're not acting on it very much.
Well, I should probably jump on my standard weekly report on the...
Yeah, let's do that. And then we'll get back to the records, because it's a good question.
For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which Steve was talking about, is up 0.45%. The S&P 500 up 0.26%. The NASDAQ Composite up 0.94%. Nothing too terribly impressive there. Actually... until you look now, if you look back a year, the Dow's up 31.6, the S&P 500 is up 24.1, and the NASDAQ is up 34%. Now, as Jake said just a minute ago, the issue is that the market is as high as its price-to-earnings ratio. In other words, the ratio of the price of a share, and there you can't actually buy a share in the S&P 500, but Standard & Poor's
they've got some good indexes that follow
they refer to shares, an individual share in there being the price that they quote. The earnings per share as a ratio is almost exactly the same as it was a year ago when the market was 34% lower. And the Dow was 34% lower. So we've got no rise. Now, this is going to sound goofy. There's actually been no rise in the price of the market since last year when everybody was bad-mouthing the United States economy.
Yeah, and when you say 34, that was the NASDAQ. 31's the Dow, and 24 is the...
Yeah, but the point is that the market, the price went up because the earnings went up. Now, that's healthy. And the price-to-earnings ratio is very much in line with historic norms
That's kind of right at the long-term average.
Right. And so...
which means that it's not overpriced or underpriced. It's just about right.
What's left to cause the market to rise going forward? That's the question. Or what might cause the market to fall going forward? If it's running, if it's being driven by earnings. And it is. Because yesterday... we had this week. We had major announcements. A new nominee
To the Federal Reserve
to
as
be the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and a major tax law change that's just going to upend, if it were to go through all the way as it is, would upend corporate taxes.
The market just barely did anything.
It just the
it's
market
a
just
minuscule
said,
upward movement.
Yeah, but it went upward.
Minuscule.
Actually, if you look what happened, it went upward because several corporations reported better than expected earnings.
Right.
Apple, for example, said, hey, we're doing better than expected.
What that means is that the market as a whole really doesn't expect anything from Congress. I think they would be surprised at this point if we get tax reform. I think it's more likely that we'll get tax reform than we won't. But I'd still say it's very close to 50-50. We're probably talking about 52% chance of it passing from my perspective. If I were running numbers on this, I would probably say we'll do 52% because they still have to get 49 Republican senators to vote for it. And they haven't been keeping that.
They have to get all 50.
They have to get... Oh, yeah, they have to get 50 Republican senators, and then the vice president would have to come in and vote for it, too. And I think the vice president would vote for it.
Well, you never can tell. He's awful quiet.
He is. He's very quiet.
Which is very, very smart in this administration.
Yes. So far, the administration seems to be for it, but that could change.
But
this administration is known for changing its mind.
This whole issue, is the stock market overpriced? No. We got a call. We'll get a call. All right.
All right. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I don't think the market has factored it in. And the reason I say that is, you know, somebody might feel like the market has factored it in. But again, 12 months ago, during the run-up to the presidential election, nobody was talking about this tax bill. And the price-to-earnings ratio of the market was almost precisely what it is today, which means it hasn't the price-to-earnings ratio rises. I mean, you get a higher price per earnings when participants in the market anticipate greater profits in the future. Well, they obviously are thinking that the profits in the future now, and the profits in the future when we didn't know who was going to be the next president, are the same.
Well, yeah, and let me kind of throw this in there, because when people talk about it being factored in, that is often the case when things are much more predictable. If we have a situation where we think for sure we're going to get X, whatever that is, the market tends to factor that in fairly well. When we're talking about something that most people really don't expect to happen, is tax reform going to happen? Well, healthcare reform or insurance reform didn't happen. The Affordable Care Act proposal didn't happen. And if you count the false starts, that was tried about 12 times between the Senate and the House to get something done, and it failed miserably every time.
And I think the market is saying there's a 50-50 chance we'll get tax reform.
Which means that they're pricing in a half-half, which means they're not moving up dramatically or down dramatically. Now, if it doesn't pass, we might get a little low for a while on the market. I wouldn't even say a big low, because it really doesn't appear to be the reason why people are buying. If it was the reason why people were buying, so this is the other end of the coin. If the market expects tax reform, then what we should be doing as a market, if it is really expected, would be to buy a lot of stocks right now, huge amounts of stocks, because corporate tax rates, according to this proposal, will drop drastically. And some stocks that would be most effective have most affected by this tax proposal have moved a little bit. But the ones that have moved a little bit, and people can say tax reform proposal came out, look, these stocks have acted differently than the others. There's no earnings report that have come out that say it's different. They've only moved about 5%, which means even in the ones most affected, people don't think it's going to be a big change.
You know, if you're making bets, which I don't recommend, but if you're making bets, the several analysts came out yesterday and said, okay, if this thing passes exactly as is, it will add, on average, to the S&P 500 4% earnings.
Which is pretty nice.
You know, and earnings are up 20 some percent from last year.
If you had 20, or but, if you had four to that.
There's then... actually only a couple of things that move the market. One is earnings, and that's what the market is being driven on.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is change in price-earnings ratio. In other words, if the price-earnings ratio goes up, that means people are speculating things will be better in the future than they are today. So those are really the only two things that move stock prices. Change in price-earnings ratio or change in earnings.
And everything else comes down to that, because when people are buying stocks, they really want their stock to appreciate in value. And if you're making that decision saying, I want more than what I put into it, if you're willing to pay more, it's because you think that it's going to be higher. And the biggest marker for that is price-to-earnings ratio. Now, in the year 2000, what was the price-to-earnings ratio on the S&P?
In 2000, at this point, when the last time we had unemployment this low was about 30. And it went to 45 before it peaked out.
Right. So we had
that was in 2001.
We had a 45 price-to-earnings ratio. And just for simple English, take the math completely out of this. 45 means at current today's earnings, it would take 45 years of those earnings to pay you back if you were to buy that stock today.
Another way of looking at it is the earnings yield, which is a much easier way to figure this out. On the S&P 500 at that point was just like 2.01%. In other words, it was like you were buying a bond at 2.01%.
With a lot more risk. Bond with a lot of risk.
If you buy the whole stock market, there's no more risk, I think, than there is buying the whole bond market.
Right, but yeah, that's true.
The today's yield, earnings yield, the forward price earnings ratio is 18, the trailing is 20, man. There's not much difference between them, but basically it's between 5% and 7% is the yield, the earnings yield on the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. So rationally,
we're not at the kind of bubble that we saw in 2000. We're not at the kind of bubble we saw even in 2007.
If you were to buy something, a Bulzaka, let's say a...
Did you just make that up?
Yes.
A Bulzaka?
Let's say a widget note, okay? That's something else. I don't know what a widget note is. But let's say you buy a widget note and they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to pay you...
A widget note sold by fill-in-the-blank company.
Right, fill-in-the-blank.
Yeah. Right, yeah, gotcha. And we've got a whole company getting
lawyers,
here.
The law firm that issued the widget note was Dewey, Cheatham & Howe.
Right.
But the if you were to buy one and it said, okay, we are going to pay 7% interest, we're going to reinvest 5 or 4.5 and give you 2.5 in cash. That's the equivalent of buying a share which you can't do in the S&P 500 today, which is why people are buying, which is why the market has room to rise, because it has a yield of about 2.5% right now. Actually, maybe a little lower. It's come up. Maybe it's lower down just below 2. But the dividend yield of the S&P 500 is about as good as you can get in a long-term bond, or better. But long-term bonds can't appreciate. They can, unless something disastrous happens, and they only appreciate temporarily and then they collapse. Whereas the stock market over long periods of time, as I mentioned in the letter we just published, right now a 23-year maturity U.S. Treasury bond is selling at 126. It's $1,260 for 1,000 bonds on the open market. It is
$260 more expensive than what will be paid back
when it matures. So there's you have a guaranteed 26% loss in $26,000
loss. It's not exactly 26%. It's more than that.
Well, whatever. You got a loss. Okay, you're going to lose for every $1,000 you invest in that bond, which admittedly is paying 4.17 is the coupon, but that didn't mean anything. It really is paying 2.71% because of the amount of money you put in, the amount of interest you'll get every year based on the amount of money you put in will be 2.71%.
That's called the yield to maturity.
And then at the end, you will lose, you will suffer a capital loss of $260.
That's factored into the 2.71% return.
Yeah, but, well, it wasn't really. This is simple yield, not yield to maturity, okay? Yield to maturity is a little different. But the point is that It's not, if interest rates rise, that bond is going to lose money. I mean, if you go to sell it, still pay you $46.71 every year, whether you need it or not, but the price will fall. You turn around and look at the stock market, and if you rationally look at the bond market and you look at the stock market, any rational person at this time would look at it and say the bond market has a much higher potential over the next 10 years to make me money. The stock market has the potential to make me money, and the bond market, which, by the way, Lehman, used to be Lehman Brothers, now it's Bloomberg Barclay composite aggregate total return bond market index, is up 0.99% for the last 12 months. And very frankly, if interest rates go up, it's going to go down. So is the stock market overpriced? No. Could it?
What we can say,
suddenly take a hit because
right now we would say
something. Yes.
Clearly the bond market is overpriced. The stock market tends to be, we would say, it's fairly priced right now. What does that mean? It means that we're not in the buyer's market so much anymore. We're not in a place where there are huge number of bargain buys out there. And we saw bargain buys all the way from the depths of the market to now. We saw lots of them. Mm-hmm. There may still be some in the less well-known areas, but then you're getting some other risk that comes with that.
Totally forgot what I was going to say.
Oh, well, we've got some commercials that we need to play. But before we do that, let's finish up the answer to the caller who said we've had lots and lots of records, record highs. Have we ever had pieces of history like that before?
Yeah, yes. We just had a record low, too.
A record low what?
Record low unemployment.
Yes. If you look back at history at record highs, where we have long streams together with low volatility, yes, we've had quite a few numbers of those. In fact, if you look at the long-term history of the market, that's more the normal situation. We just tend to remember the high volatility because it's nerve-wracking. If you look back at the decade following World War II, if you look at the decade following the Great Recession or the Great Depression, you start to see some very clear similarities. When we are coming out of a major upheaval, we tend to have much slower, less volatile growth as we go into expansion mode. So keep that in mind. This isn't something new. I haven't gotten to see a human behavior that's really new since I've been around. I can find lots and lots of times in history that human behavior is very much the same.
Even King Solomon, there is nothing new under the sun.
Well, there's plenty new under the sun. I mean, the fact that SpaceX is testing the BFG rocket, BFR rocket.
But we had a BFR rocket that took men to the moon. It was
right.
Just a different BFR.
This is a different one, so it's bigger. We're testing hypersonic planes. Where there's lots of new technology, but there's always been new technology.
It's incrementally moving forward, and that's important. I mean, we can talk about that, but you said you wanted to.
Yes, we've got some do some commercials. If you'd like to call us while we're off the air, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and you can call into the program locally at
254-773-1400.
And we'll be back on the other side with more from the Personal Wealth Coach. Ready?
And we're back with the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff.
Jake.
McClure.
There was no "and" in there. We were just Jeff Jake McClure.
It was there, it just didn't come out.
Yeah. It was the silent end.
Which the sound of the bagpipes reminds me that there's a Celtic festival going down in Austin.
It's going on down. Down on in
going
Austin.
Going down too. And next weekend, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
The Gathering of the Clans
in
Salado.
The Gathering. If you haven't been to the Gathering of the Clans, you just haven't been there. And it's a bad thing to miss the Cayley.
Yeah, we would say so. There are some people that don't like bagpipes, but I don't think they listen to this program for some reason.
The ones that don't like bagpipes, I heard a very good theological statement when we were on the island of Skye in Scotland. a gentleman there told me, I said, sky seems to me like heaven. He said, it's either like heaven or like hell. I said, what do you mean? He says, it's like heaven if you love the sound of bagpipes, it is hell otherwise. So we figured it's both.
Makes sense. Anyway, the Gathering of the Clans is next weekend. We got a Celtic festival in Austin. So your capitalist red blood cells should be happy all the way around.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the father of capitalism, Adam Smith, was a good Scotsman.
Well, he was.
We visited his grave, as a matter of fact.
Really, I understand that they've actually placed a monument to him now somewhere.
There was a big gravestone monument.
Yeah, but
there.
You had to really. There was no sign indicating how to find it. It was up against the wall, and it really took some hunting and asking a lot of people. Now, Karl Marx, you can find statues all over the place. But
yeah. So, what is it that you guys find fun for your vacation?
Hunting
we like
up
to
grave.
Go to graveyards and imagine the rotting corpse under the ground.
We have
no,
yeah, pretty cool.
Well, we do. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, tax reform and the market and.
Oh, we've got some good news. You said record unemployment. True.
Yeah, that's it. That's important to recognize. This is the lowest unemployment rate we've had since 2000, December of 2000, and that was right at the end. And I can understand why people are concerned about this.
Right.
That was right at the end of one of the biggest bull markets, and it really, that market was full of bull, too. And
right.
We'd gone through irrational exuberance into irrational insanity.
When we're looking at employment, and we're looking at cost of employment, you can see a real difference between then and now. Cost of employment went through the roof as well, which made it difficult to be in business as a company. And this is why you saw 45 as the price to earnings ratio, because the pay to the employees was taking up most of the earnings. And then there was a big downturn. People got laid off and they were hired in to do things that actually made money instead of the dot-com revolution, which most of those early dot-coms didn't make money. One of the dot-coms that's still around from there, probably the most well-known dot-com of that era, is Amazon. And it still occasionally doesn't make money. If you counted in just its sales from Amazon.com for things that you would normally buy on Amazon, it would have lost money. The difference is that it made money by selling web storage facilities and server farms and advertising. So when you think back to all of the dot-coms that sprung up that absolutely had no way of making any money back then and hiring lots of people for lots of money, we don't see a lot of new business formation that aren't really quickly showing profits. There are times throughout my lifetime where money's been a lot easier to give out for new businesses and times when it's been a lot harder to give out for new businesses. But new business formation tends to need to show some path towards profit before someone gives you money for it. That's not been the case. In the year 2000, it wasn't the case. And in for instance, the real estate market, it was not the case in 2007. So all of that's to say that there are times like this in history, quite a few of them.
The only silly investments that we're seeing right now, and silly investments tend to end badly, are into bond funds. There's
some others too, yeah.
Well, that's the only big one that I see. Massive cash flows. We're still seeing, and this is a good sign if you are expecting a more bull market. Oh, yeah, I wanted to go into something else about earnings. That's what I thought of a little while ago.
Okay.
But if you're wanting to see more bull market, it's a good sign that people are still liquidating from their stock mutual funds because they're scared and putting the money in bond mutual funds, which are overpriced.
There's another area, and it's getting a lot more mainstream attention because there is a mania forming around it. We've talked about it quite a bit this year, Bitcoin. Quite a bit. You see what I did there?
Yeah, but I don't actually know anybody who's invested in Bitcoin.
Yes, you do.
I do?
You have a son.
Oh, I didn't know he'd done it.
Who's high proponent of it. I think you're thinking of a different son. There's a one of your sons that is extremely...
But is he actually invested in it or just talked about?
No idea. I haven't looked at his bank account or any of that. But he has talked about it and has been greatly excited about it quite a lot. And if he did invest, he may have made quite a lot of money doing it. What is the problem with Bitcoin?
It's worthless.
It's the same as an emu or an ostrich. Until a lot of people are using bitcoins to buy everyday items, it's not really currency, it's a commodity. And even dollars are a commodity at that level.
And it's a commodity you can't use to manufacture anything. I mean, even gold, which I think is of questionable value because mostly it's speculative rather than used material, can be used for something.
You can use dollars the same way as a Bitcoin, and that it's just a dollar. You could build a fire out of it, but that would just be wasteful. You're not going to make a profit.
But I can go to the store and buy something with a dollar. If I have a Bitcoin, first off, I don't know how to possess a Bitcoin, so I could go to the store.
You can go and buy things with the Bitcoins.
Where?
Lots of places.
I've never seen one.
Apple Pay uses Bitcoins sometimes in some businesses, and there are a series of automated companies that you can use to pay with your phone, and you can pay in Bitcoin.
How do you get change?
You don't, just like you don't get change with a credit card or a debit card. You pay as much that it converts to dollars as soon as you're using
it. But when you spend a Bitcoin, can you spend half a Bitcoin?
Yeah, you can spend fractional Bitcoins.
You can?
Yes.
I was unaware of that.
No, you can go.
Who owns the rest? Does the majority owner of the Bitcoin still own the Bitcoin?
No, it's kind of like money in that sense. If you have a penny in your pocket, it's yours, not the person that owns the majority of the dollar.
Yeah, but if I have a dollar and I convert it to change, I give the dollar to somebody and they now own the dollar,
right,
and they give me back some coins.
Yes. In that case, yes, that is true. You have given them only you don't have to change it that way. It isn't a physical object that changes into another physical object. It just fractionalizes.
If I want to go buy a car or buy a house, I can use it. I can go and...
be more difficult to buy something like that, but yes, you could. It would get converted to dollars immediately.
No, without converting it to dollars.
That's the point, is it would, in most cases, unless you're dealing strictly with only people that want to accept a Bitcoin for a Bitcoin's sake, it's very hard to do that kind of transaction.
And it doesn't qualify as currency.
And I agree with that. It's more like a chicken egg with no meaning other than it looks pretty.
Well, at least you can get a chicken out of a chicken egg.
Yeah, there's no meaning to a Bitcoin.
And people, you can't wear them, so they don't look pretty.
The thing about the Bitcoin is it's a lot more like the craze around emus and ostriches, or the alpaca for that matter.
And I agree with you completely that it is like the ostrich.
It's a mania, or maybe a tulip.
But the difference is you could eat the ostrich egg.
You weren't supposed to eat the tulip. Okay, and yes, it looked pretty.
And you could grow it and it'd be look pretty and people think.
There are people that would lock their tulips away in a garden that nobody could look at. Back in the tulip mania in the Dutch time period. And people do that with Bitcoins. They open up their Bitcoin locker and they look at it and it's kind of like Scrooge McDuck saying, this is how many I have. Why is it a bad idea to have it? There are the easiest one, and whomever invented the Bitcoin, we don't know who that is.
Yes.
The
anonymous one.
Right. We put a cap on the number of Bitcoins that could exist in the world at 22 million. It's part of the algorithm. The algorithm gets changed regularly. It's kind of like a vote of ownership in the Bitcoins, and there's some infrastructure in place there. The problem, and they've kept that, it's 22 million. You can't have more than those Bitcoins out there ever,
right,
except that there are now dozens of different types of cryptocurrencies that have all given themselves their own cap on the number. So why would you use a Bitcoin versus Ethereum versus any number of the others that are out there? The initial coin offerings are big enough now as far as money going into it. About $2 billion has flowed into this over the past year. It's big enough now that some of the big movers are looking at it saying, let's do an exchange. We can put it on an index. The options board is looking at it. So why is it a problem? Because it's being treated very much like options. There's even a futures options market opening for it. It's pure gambling. There is a options market on the S&P 500 where you can buy the futures market on the S&P 500. You don't actually ever buy anything in the S&P 500. It is a bet as to what you think it's going to do. You get paid if you're betting that it's going to go up. You get paid if it goes up. If you're betting that it goes down, you get paid if it goes down. Now you get to lose money if it goes the opposite direction.
Literally all of it.
It is gambling in a very clear sense. So is Bitcoin. There is nothing fundamentally profit earning in a Bitcoin. There is nothing about a Bitcoin that says it needs to go up in value, except that people are buying it right now. It's very much like when people were buying three primary residences. That's an oxymoron. Or drcoop.com. You've got to have some reason for a growth associated with Bitcoin. Bitcoins have gone up hundreds of percent this year. They are not doing anything to accrue that value. It's just a lot of people buying them because they've gone up. People that buy things because they go up are often people who sell things because they go down, which means the downward slope may be faster than the upward one.
The value of the Bitcoin is based on the greater fool theory.
Yes.
And you always assume there's a greater, if you're into that, it's kind of like the people who bought DR Coop who had no plan to make money, but
it's been going up, so I'm going to buy it. Somebody will buy it from me at a higher value and sometime and down the road.
Historically, this type of investment mania ends unhappily.
So the fact that I have heard it from people that don't know how to check email, should I buy Bitcoin? The fact that it's a common enough question means it doesn't have a huge far way to go if we're the ones running, if we are the ones running the mania. We're not. The Chinese are. And when the Chinese stop buying, that's when we should expect some problems.
Yeah. I started to say that Bitcoin has no utility, but that's not true.
It
has a utility as a money transfer vehicle to get money out of China.
Yes. They can buy Bitcoins with yuan, get them and sell them for dollars, and they can't take their own currency and sell it for dollars right now. So we're about out of time for this hour.
I was going to talk about something.
Well, we should talk about something next hour.
I'll talk about it next hour.
As opposed to what we had planned, which is to talk about nothing next hour.
That's a big subject, though.
Then it would be a political news program.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Use a lot of words.
So if you'd like to contact us off the air, the Personal Wealth Coach does give fiduciary investment advice to high net worth people. We have a local number with voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week.
And the area code is 254, but it's 947. This is hard to remember, 947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.